recording in Ben Lomond, California on February 22nd, 2016. This is Geek Speak, episode 8 of season 16. You're listening to independent public radio 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxler, your host and producer of Geek Speak, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Lyle, how you doing?
I'm quite well. Good to see you. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Mr. Miles Elam is also here, software engineer, political junkie. Hi, Miles.
Hello.
Miles, did you hear this crazy news science story? This is actually from Science Alert, and it's hyperbolic in nature, but also kind of cool. And that is that it's possible with the new storage technology for archive storage to save 360 terabytes of data on a small little glass disk for 13.8 billion years. I'm assuming the time is theoretical.
Yeah, well, considering that's the age of the entire universe, yeah, I'd call that theoretical. I don't know if we have anything that we go, hey, here's this rock that's 13.8 billion years old.
And this is where we always bring up, like, we've got another 5 billion years till the expansion of our sun nearly or does consume our Earth. I assume it wouldn't survive that.
Not so much.
Basically, they're etching in multi-layers with lasers, polarized light. They're calling it, this is the part that's just as irritating as heck, they're calling it the five-dimensional storage medium.
But that's totally accurate.
Well, it's accurate when you declare your variables as differences. Like, it's three dimensions. It goes up and down the layer and left and right and back and forth, right? So those are three dimensions. And then the other dimensions are size.
Yeah, which, how big the dot is, how small it is, yeah.
Yeah, but the size is not a dimension. Size is a dimension of those, or is a property of those other sizes, of X, Y, and Z, right?
But what if you, by changing the size of the dot, you dramatically increase the storage size? It's a dimension.
You understand where I'm coming from?
No, I get that you think of the fourth dimension as time. And
no, it's not about that. It's much more about telling people it's five-dimensional. It's not five-dimensional. All of it fits in our dimensions of three dimensions perfectly. And it's not a time-based thing, right?
Yeah, but I think of many, like, for example, in computer science or in programming, you can have multidimensional things that go way beyond 3D.
Absolutely.
And it's talking about they are different access ways to
different
get to that data.
Different properties or different attributes, if you will. And yeah, size, and I think it's also orientation of the disk or something.
But polarization,
Yeah, polarization. And these are properties. And polarization is a good one to talk about because it is a different type of thing. You can have two opposite polarized things in the same physical location and be able to differentiate them. So that one feels good to me. The size does not feel good to me, but maybe it's the same thing where the actual shape of the dot and the size, you could lay them on top of each other and therefore they are dimensionally different. Well, in any case, yes, this is definitely a true story. And the cool thing about this is a long-term archive effect, right? It's not really about speed. It's not really going to replace your hard drive. But the idea is that we can store tons of data in really small spaces for a long period of time.
So I remember back in the days when I had a 300 megabyte hard drive and using 800K floppy disks, there was this idea of a TeraCube that was supposed to come along the way. And it was going to shoot lasers into some one-inch cube medium to store.
I think we covered on GeekSpeak a dozen years ago. Literally a dozen years ago.
I think you're right.
So are you saying it's not a terabyte? We now get 300 times of that?
I wish that somebody would actually now release the terabyte optical disc or, you know, cube while we've got like other things out there that are actually better than that already. Speaking of which, Miles.
Speaking of which, things that we have already.
Storage
there.
Mediums larger than 1 terabyte? I mean, that was pretty good.
What we were talking about with 5D is saying it enables up to 360 terabytes of capacity on a 1-inch diameter, disk.
Yeah. But for archive purposes, long form. And we need this. Why? Well, like, why do we actually need that?
Because as it stands right now, we have nothing that is on the level of, say, a clay tablet. that we get from like
clay
the Sumerians.
Tablets? They're a lot on the level of clay tablets.
Yeah, but they're
not. Oh, you mean for computer storage mediums?
Yes. The amount of data that we have is complete, like all the data of the world right now that's digitized is dependent upon us constantly moving from one medium to another and never stopping.
Wait a second. Oh, something about this article finally makes sense. I read this article and it bugged me because they stressed that you could look at this little tiny disk that has all of these dots imprinted inside of it through lasers, and you could look at it with a microscope and actually see mm-hmm. what's going on in there. That made no sense to me for the longest time, because why would you ever look at ones and zeros with a microscope? But in 5 billion years, what device is going to be left to read this thing?
Well, hopefully 5 billion years from now, it'll be very much like we find one of our old 5 1/4 inch floppies and go like, oh, what's this? Oh, wow, that game really is bad.
No, okay, but really, I want to get back to that little thought on that. But right, what you're saying is, yes, the idea is that you could lose civilization, some other civilization to arise and look at these things and actually be able to backwards figure them out.
I don't have a zip disk reader. I barely have a CD reader. I don't have any floppy readers anymore. The technology is changing too fast in our lifetime, let alone an archival storage medium that has to last hundreds, thousands, billions of years.
Right. And all that stuff, yeah, word of note, all you folks that have those zip disks that have been sitting in your closet for, you know, 15 years, you might want to move them to another media and like move it to your hard drive or something okay. like that if you want to keep them.
So this new medium proves to be long-term storage and probably be able to backwards figure it out without knowing a lot about it. That's another aspect of it, I think.
As long as people can figure out binary.
And they can figure out
and size,
polarization yeah. and all these different things. But assuming in a successfully advanced technology species, you could potentially backwards figure this out.
Well, yeah, yeah. I guess it's kind of like the prime directive. We don't want to give technology to people who can't grasp it, but then they...
I don't think it's applicable to species that happen after us. But anyway, that's not the point I want to argue. The point is, who cares? Like, why would we want to store anything for a billion years? Why would it matter?
For a billion years, it's hard to say just because we have no context for what a billion years is.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine...
Let's say 10,000 years.
No, but I mean, imagine if bacteria from a billion and a half years ago
mm-hmm.
could have written down what their ecosystem was like and what their respiration was like and what...
It would definitely be edifying to us, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, having data available, whether someone wants to use that data is a whole separate conversation.
I just think it's a little presumptuous of us to think that what we want to store is important to a species that comes 10,000 years later.
The distinction between media that can last 500 years or 1,000 years, or let's say 2,000 years, the equivalent time between us and the Roman Empire, is interesting to us, is useful to us.
Yeah, right. All I have to do is say the Library of Alexandria, right?
Right.
And we are going into an age where most of the data we have is not on paper, which actually lasts a long time. Mm-hmm. It's on computers. So if we don't kind of capture this era...
Well, paper, as long as it's acid-free, but yeah.
And
all sorts of caveats.
So what about CDs and optical drives? I mean, when we first started covering CDs on GeekSpeak, we talked a lot about them lasting for a long time. And it was always a bit of like, well, do they really? They're archival. They're gold-plated, you know?
It depends upon the disc. Some discs are better than others. You can't know ahead of time necessarily which ones are going to be of higher quality or whether a company had a bad batch or just has lower...
So your comment about zip discs is equally applicable to CDs or DVDs sitting around, right?
Zip discs are a magnetic media platter. They're similar to what we had with floppy discs.
Sure.
And in some ways similar to what we have with hard drives.
But
and
get the data off them.
They are a lot more volatile okay. than an optical disc. An optical disc, under good circumstances, you can have a CDR that, if it was made correctly, lasts for 75, 100 years.
But that's the thing, is if you're going to take a CD and you have your only copy of photographs on there from your family, or like a video of your kid walking for the first time, and it's on a CD and you think you're being smart, and it's only one copy, and that disc happens to be a bad form or got bacteria in it or something, it's going to go.
Or for that matter, the fact that when you have these archived, they're supposed to last for 75 to 100 years, you have to keep them at the correct humidity and temperature at all times. Right. It's like what the Vatican does with their old documents from way back when.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
but I think your point, Lyle, is that it's very presumptuous to us to think that our data is important. And so I guess the real, I don't know, the real deal is on us to actually edit what we put on there.
Right.
No, because if you think of historians, a lot of times when they're looking at items, they're looking at whatever they can get their hands on.
Sure, absolutely.
And there's a whole lot of stuff that may be old that is common. It's the same person saying the same thing or the same group of people saying the same thing. And so it's like, okay, here's this common theme. Okay, I don't need to hear that every single time.
I get that.
But you don't know ahead of time what is going to be interesting or the last copy of something.
Sure, I get
for
that.
For a researcher.
Great examples of this is that, you know, in 1950s, what people were doing in the bathroom before getting ready for work. Maybe not a lot of information about it, right? Like, mm-hmm. How were they brushing their teeth? You know, like, of course, the 50s, of course, not far enough along for us to not know. but there's definitely eras where we don't know these kind of details because no one at the time thought it was important. Mm-hmm. And it would be edifying.
Or for that matter, the pronunciation.
Oh, that's a good one. Language,
like, yeah. How did Shakespeare actually say the things? And we think we know, but wouldn't it be cool to have a recording of his voice?
Sure. I get that. And the other side of that is I have a relatively large photograph collection, you know, like 200,000 photographs that I've taken and, you know, pulled in and archive and manage it and back it up and all that stuff. And of course, those photos at some point were relatively important. A lot of them are just junk. But even let's say we have, you know, I have 10,000 photos of one of my kid. Does that really matter? Like, even to me and my family directly, that's too many.
So like, how many times have you taken photos and been like, okay, this is okay, this is okay, this is okay, and junk photos that you didn't care about, and then that family member dies, and you forget about the photos for 10, 20 years, and you look back and you're like, oh, you don't know ahead of time what is going
right.
to be junk.
Except that I'm weird enough in the head that I'm always thinking about if I have a good photo of a person that I know so that when they pass away, there's a good photo of them. So there's maybe a little bit of sickness in my mind. I have great photos of you, by the way, Miles. You can go anytime you want.
I love how you're talking about this at this age of big data we keep hearing about, where the idea, especially since Google Photos, you bring up photos, Google mm-hmm. Photos was released last year with this ability to go in and algorithmically figure out what's in each photo. So if you have this treasure trove of data sitting around that you can't deal with now, the promise is in the future you get to use all these algorithms to use it.
And for that matter, what was most important to people in aggregate?
Yeah, okay. I get the idea of understanding our society in aggregate from a future historian perspective. At the same time, the more data you have about a certain thing, the less interesting that becomes. I mean, our society is not going to have a dearth of personal selfies, right? That's not going to be something like, oh, I wish we had more pictures of people's
unless we get archival media, it would be.
So I'm in this perspective that as long as our society continually has a technical stability, you know, if we don't go back to the Stone Ages or something, I think we'll still have, or we'll move our data along.
But we also have the influence of things like copyright. Like there are things from
the
50s that were on TV that were recorded, and there's only one copy that exists, and it's the original film, and it's copywritten, so no one else can use it except the copyright holder, and the copyright holder has no interest in it. There's no financial gain from it. And by the time it exits copyright, assuming copyright ever exits, thank you, Mickey Mouse, the film may have degraded to the point where it is gone.
Okay, so let me just ask you this. It's possible at this time to record every moment of your life easily and store it forever. Like, that's not really a problem. We could actually have, like, all the, you know, relatively affable people in the world could do that right now.
Battery technology is an issue in remembering to charge your camera, but yeah.
But, you know, it's doable if we wanted to do that.
Sure.
Would that being done at 100% versus that being done at 20% matter at all in a historical perspective? Because from a historical perspective, the amount of data it would be astronomical. It would be hard to process, hard
Assuming
to manage.
That future society was more advanced than we were?
They might be able to glean more information out of it.
Well, their ability to have an algorithm go through and go, yeah, this is all junk, this is all junk. Hey, this is something that's different. Take a look
at that. Okay, let me put it this way. Let's say 20,000 years ago, you're on the plain somewhere and there's an indigenous people there that are hunting. Okay, their traveling hunting tribe, and you get 30 hours of a week of their lives on video. Mm-hmm. That is amazing.
Yes.
Because now you know all about them. It's just an incredible explosion of knowledge.
All about that one group of people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, instead, from that one group, you get 3,000 hours. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Which is better? Like, what is actually a better representation of that group? Is it better to have more of that information? Because, oh, look, he holds his spear to the left sometimes. Like, at some point, it's going to be like, oh, boring.
No, this is the argument that is made specifically for shooting raw photos. You're getting more information than you need for the final output because you don't know what you might need to bring out or suppress.
High-end cameras can record video photo formats in a larger format called RAW. And when we actually get a JPEG, or what's JPEG stand for?
Joint Picture Experts Group.
When you get an export of that quality, you've actually made a whole bunch of decisions about how you want the image processed. One of the most specific examples is white balance. You have to kind of set that. A RAW image doesn't have an idea of white balance. It's just like, this is all the RAW pictures.
Isn't RAW what it comes right off the CCD, or is that not the case?
It's pretty much that. It's a little bit of a processing course because it's got to take the matrix and put it into storage. But I shoot in RAW all the time, so point taken. Miles, I get that. But I think that I probably overdo it. I think there's a level at which you should exist in the moment and not worry about archiving for the future.
But you don't know ahead of time which things are important. This is like talking about species. Like, when did we start becoming human beings and stop being Cro-Magnon or something like that? And you can't know when a species diverge unless
they don't really.
Unless you go back in time and see, like, okay, here's where we're making the arbitrary deciding point. You know, here's where it is now a chicken and not a proto chicken.
Okay, I get it. I get it. So Lyle wants our age to be valuable, and the only way to make it valuable is to make it sparse, to make it rare.
Sounds like the monologue of a superhero.
Everybody's got to use zip disks from now on.
No, it sounds like the monologue of a supervillain before they destroy a city. If I destroy it now, it'll be more worthy.
Yeah, Lex Luthor taking out the West Coast, so he has all that coastal property after the earthquakes.
What about storage mediums? This is archive, long-term, theoretical, blah, blah, blah. But we also have new technology hitting the stores, right?
Yes. A couple months ago, I guess, talked about how SSDs were kind of changing the landscape. They were supplanting hard drives in many ways. The speed difference between your general storage and your main system processing was diminishing. Well, one of the things we talked about then was the fact that hard drives are cheaper, which is still the case.
Spinning hard drives.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spinning Rust. And the fact that they were larger.
Yes.
That you
cheaper
get a
and larger.
Yeah, 6 or 8 terabyte hard drive, and the largest that you could get for a SSD was about 1 terabyte at the time we were talking about. I think maybe 2 terabytes had just come out. Well, Intel is partnering with Micron to make 10 terabyte solid-state drives for the enterprise market.
Now, wait a second. A bunch of times we talk about upcoming technology, like this archival technology, but is this coming?
This is within a year.
Okay, within, and they're promising within a year.
Yeah.
You mean time for the holiday seasons. Here's a hint. I'd love that. That would be great.
Very expensive.
I would imagine it'd be extremely expensive. I have a terabyte SSD in my laptop, and it is very lovely. You looks like you have a bolted on terabyte.
Yeah, I got half a terabyte hanging off the back of my screen.
I got a terabyte. It's 512 times 2. RAID 0.
Oh, you...
Oh, yeah.
You have an NAS device or something?
Well, no, it's. I took the optical drive out and put a second SSD in.
Didn't you guys talk about this 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, let's not talk about it again. Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KSPM. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Brian Young and Miles Elam. We're about to chat about an open letter from the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, and to us all and to the FBI. So stay with us, won't you? It's Geek Speak here on KSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Miles Elam and Brian Young. Hey.
Hey, so did you hear?
About Tim Cook's letter?
Yeah. So it's like the one of those largest, powerful companies on the planet, and the U.S. government, top officials in the U.S. government, are having a blog off.
A blog off?
Yeah, sure. Tim Cook's going to his blog, it happens to be Apple's website, and what is it? James Comey, the head of the FBI, is going to Lawfare and doing his own blog post.
Oh, I hadn't read that blog post. Well, let's first describe What's Tim Cook's blog entry that started it out? What's it say?
Okay, so this is a huge topic.
Last we left our heroes.
So this topic gets into politics. It gets into social or public policy. It gets into a lot of stuff. And we're gonna try to focus on the tech angle of this. But okay. The idea is that in San Bernardino, there was this the shooting,
the terrorist
shooting, mm-hmm. and a phone was left behind after the end of this, and the FBI wants to get as much possible data off this phone as they can
for prosecution of this man who did this terrorist, allegedly did this terrorist
act. No, right? This is where it gets interesting. There's no prosecution involved because the man is dead.
Okay, so is it looking for, they want data so they can figure out how he did it, how he planned it, and if there's any accomplices?
I'm sure they want data to figure out that, although there doesn't appear to be any indication of accomplices.
Okay, so, but we're all agreed this guy was not such a good person.
No, this guy is a bad person.
Okay.
And this case is an excellent case for the FBI getting the data. In fact, this person didn't even own the phone. The phone was owned by the San Bernardino, which organization was that? It was a government organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's owned by it's basically, it was an employer-owned, so state-owned city of San Bernardino.
Yeah.
But they weren't using all the security features capable of the phone.
They did not use the ability to put their own profile on there, which would have given them access to
it. What is that called when you've got a secondary profile that actually has rights to the phone? Do you know what that's called? But in any case, so this phone is not owned by him. It's being used. It's a resource of the government, actually.
Yes.
This guy used it. I'm assuming, encrypted with his thumbprint and that whole thing, right?
Well, no, it didn't even have the thumbprint. In fact, the model that he owned, well, not owned, that the government owned, the model that his employer gave him is a iPhone 5C, which did not include the fingerprint reader.
Mm-hmm.
It did not include what they call the secure enclave,
sure,
which is a chip inside the phone that actually is a separate computer that manages security.
Right.
So
this stuff doesn't exist in it.
No,
in
it doesn't.
This model.
It doesn't exist in this model.
Got it.
What I wanted to stress is here, the FBI is doing their job, and nobody in this, I believe, is doing anything particularly malicious. Everybody is acting on their interests. Law enforcement, FBI, is attempting to be as proactively working on this case to get as much information to keep us safe.
So what's the conflict?
Well, the conflict is through a couple things we'll get into a little bit. They can't access the data that's actually on the phone. The user of the phone used a 4-digit passcode, and that 4-digit passcode has them locked out.
1,000 answers.
There's 1,000 answers.
10,000.
Sorry, 10,000
answers. 10,000 answers. So in order to get the information on that phone, the FBI needs a way to enter that password. Well,
why don't you just guess the 10,000 answers? It's going to take a while, but
yeah,
it won't be
because,
that bad.
Because Apple has a whole bunch of security features. One of the ones they have on there, which I think most parents don't turn on, is the ability to, after 10 wrong guesses, to erase any data that's on there.
Well, you erase the decryption key,
yes,
which then renders the drive.
So there's actually really good security in the phone encryption layer. The very very large key gets generated. All the data on the disk on the phone is being encrypted with that large number, and then the large number is wrapped up in a 4-digit PIN. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you can do longer PINs if you're longer passwords if you want.
Like
all of us have longer PINs, right?
Yep.
Oh yeah.
And so basically you encrypt that. So as long as you could theoretically guess this figure, the security features that protect that data, meaning it could be erased. We don't necessarily know if that's on or not because you can't access to the phone.
No, we do know that that's on. In fact, I correct myself. It has to be a 6-digit one if it's iOS 9. The FBI is not trying to get around break the encryption. The encryption is strong and nobody can break that. That's math. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get the phone in a state where they can put as many guesses in as quickly as possible so that they have a chance to put in the right password.
So they can guess the 6-digit PIN or 4-digit PIN, whatever.
Right. But the operating system is made in such a way that if they did that, they would erase the encryption key and lose access to the data.
If I was the FBI, I would just say, hey, let's make an operating system that wouldn't erase the data after multiple guesses.
What a great idea.
Is that what the FBI did to Apple?
No. Well, they haven't done that to
Apple.
But
they asked that.
But yeah, they requested that, and Apple said no.
Why can't you get somebody like me to whip up something that could do this? What?
Okay,
is that not possible?
First of all, there's a whole community out there that does this. First of all, there's the NSA, and then there's jailbreakers.
Right.
And their whole mission is to find flaws in Apple security and get access to the phone so they can have full control of it and put whatever software they want on there. All of the, well, most of those assume that you actually have access and have gotten past the password part. Okay. But the reason why the FBI can't just produce an operating system that they could install on the phone and use is because of an encryption reason. Every OS that's put on Apple's phone has to be signed with a private key that Apple controls so that the phone will look for that and knows the public key. And if they match, if the encryption passes, it'll allow the operating system on the phone.
This
Apple
is how
has full control of that key.
And this is how we have successful updates over the wire from Apple. And you know it's from Apple and not from Miles, because Apple's is made their patch to the operating system, signs it with their private key, and then we get a copy on our phone. And the phone looks at it and says, I'm authenticating it. Looks like it's good. It's been signed successfully. And then it accepts the code. So there's like there's a layer in the phone that has to have a handshake with a secret that Apple has. Yeah?
Exactly.
And that sounds like a really good, important feature to have, because you wouldn't want someone to put in malicious software on your machine.
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, if this was done 10 or 15 years ago, people would have cried murder. In fact, people have cried for the 7 or 8 years that Apple has released the iPhone, because it creates this walled garden. Apple is the gatekeeper.
So because Apple controls completely what can go on the device, that's why the FBI needs Apple.
Well, this is where it gets political. Yes, the FBI is requesting of Apple. Now, when I say it gets political, there's lots of people to think that the NSA or other groups probably have the ability to defeat Apple's security. But this case seems to be made for a reason to confront some tech company to get them to do something that the FBI would like to have happen in the future as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's a precedence case.
Yeah, it's definitely a precedent case.
Well, let's also talk about, yes, they can sign that software and then put it in, put it into the phone, but we're also talking about installing that software that has been correctly signed, in this case, without having the phone unlocked ahead of time. That's a separate thing. That is, because whenever we're updating phones, like, it will tell us when we log back into the phone, oh yeah, you've got an update. Do you want to do it now, or do you want to have it happen at 2 p.m. whatever? And so you have specifically requested it or allowed it to happen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just happen, and it certainly doesn't happen because you plug your phone into your laptop and walk away.
Well,
okay, that's a good point.
There's a special mode called DFU mode, which any iPhone can go into where it can start accepting commands. So I don't think that's a huge problem.
But I thought DFU mode would only be able to reinstall an operating system. It wouldn't be able to maintain the existing data.
Well, there's data in operating system. It doesn't have to overwrite
the data. Well, I'm
sorry,
not overwrite the data, but I'm...
Hmm. So I know everybody that I've read talks about the DFU mode as the way it is the means in there. But let's first talk about the technology. It is conceivable for Apple to go into their source code for their operating system and break the security.
Well, okay, so all that has to happen here is they have to turn off that thing that says erase after a certain amount of tries and speed up the try. If they do slow down mm-hmm. the trying of the pins,
right.
Just speed that up.
All you're doing is asking for something to be created which goes against all of Apple's business plan. Mm-hmm. It goes against what customers who purchase Apple's products believe they're getting. It goes against, it brings into the world something that, even if it's entirely tied to this one phone, and even if Apple keeps control over that phone and only allows the FBI to access the data, it brings something into existence which they didn't want to create, that they were forced to create, and that makes it, illustrates that it is possible to be created.
Provides a roadmap or a blueprint of how to get into a device that ostensibly would never be repaired.
Yes. So if it can be created, if the FBI can ask for it, China can ask for it, and Russia can ask
for it. Okay, so now that's not hyperbole, because, of course, for Apple to be in China, Apple has to abide by the laws of China, right? And therefore, if one of the laws is, hey, when a court says do this, you do it, that Apple has to do that. Like, that's one of the deals about being in a country. You abide by their laws. So it's not hyperbole at all to say that China could definitely ask for the same thing under different circumstances, right? Whatever their laws abide by.
And the ultimate recourse that Apple would have would be to leave that market.
Which Apple probably doesn't want to do.
Or actually, the ultimate recourse that Apple has is the stance that they are taking, which is saying, we need to make it so that no one can do it.
It seems to me that this request is relatively simple. So,
but you're talking about relatively simple. This also talks about you need someone that has intimate knowledge with the operating system and its security workings, and you're going to take them or the group of people off of whatever they are working on for Apple's actual product releases. Yeah,
let me just quote somebody about that exact topic. Congressman Ted Lieu, Democrat of Los Angeles County, responded to this. It's kind of an open letter as well.
In fact, he's one of four congressmen that has a computer science degree.
I like this guy already. And he talks a lot about, you know, the terrorist attacks is unforgivable and all those things. But then he gets into the detail. He says, this FBI court order by compelling a private sector company to write new software is essentially making that company an arm of law enforcement. Private sector companies are not and should not be an arm of the government or law enforcement. And that is kind of the crux of it, right? You're kind of, you're taking a law and making somebody do something. It's kind of equivalent to make, you know, the government asking me specifically to do something. Is that kind of what you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, but I guess I take it from the technical point of view of once you allow a hole, even if it's for good purposes, that opens the door for it to be used for not good purposes.
So let's talk about security here. There's two issues. There's security and there's privacy. And in this case, security is the one that's really important. So there's a lot of people involved in security. And the general consensus is if everybody doesn't have security, nobody has security. Now, the idea behind that is once there's some exploit, some weakness to the security, it doesn't matter whether one person controls it. Eventually, that exploit gets out. It gets found out. It gets figured out.
Okay, and that is the concern of you can't just give a secret key to one person and then think that nobody else is going to get the key. That's the kind of analogy you're pulling, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in this situation, the real key that is of importance is Apple's ability to install stuff on the phone, which they do control, and it is a secret that they have.
Yeah, but then they're going to be asked again.
Okay, so let me ask you this.
Again.
What if the FBI was just saying, you know what, you don't have to do any work. All you have to do is give us the keys so that we can sign stuff that goes on the phone. That, of course, would be worse, right? Because then it would be open. The government could theoretically do this anytime they wanted without a public outcry of Apple.
Right. And Apple does allow, with a proper warrant and court order, access to iCloud data.
Right.
Which is another wrinkle to this story.
Because the FBI has backups from 6 weeks prior.
Well, what happened was after the event, then Apple said, hey, you know what we could do? Just plug the phone back in, it'll sync up to iCloud servers, and we can capture that backup and see what's on the phone. See what
Wait a second. Okay.
Are.
The reason why Apple always says, do you want to use iCloud and has a little description of what it is because it's saying, if you do this, there's another vulnerability. Right? Your privacy is not actually guaranteed necessarily because that data is available in Apple's cloud, and therefore Apple could access it at some level.
Right. And they do provide with a court order that data from iCloud. Like that law enforcement comes, they say, hey, we have this legal order to do this, and Apple reviews it and goes, oh, yeah, okay.
Well, why isn't that enough? Why are we going forward?
That's the funny thing, is because when they plugged the phone back in, they found that it didn't actually sync. So Apple's going, what's going on? Why isn't it syncing?
We know the answer now. Now that this information has kind of come out in drips and drabs, but we know that at some point, the iCloud password was reset. And there's a little bit back and forth on who reset it, but
not anymore.
Apparently, the FBI requested of the San Bernardino
officials
that they reset the password because they believed they would get access to iCloud itself to retrieve the backups.
Oh, so they could do it themselves without a court order from going to Apple.
Yeah, but they didn't seem to understand is at the moment of resetting the password to get access to the iCloud account to get the backups, they then removed the ability for them to make it backup further because they at that time, they couldn't have known how many backups there were.
They basically de-authenticate the phone's ability to talk to iCloud.
Right. Okay. The equivalent would be you unlock the phone would ask, hey, what's your iCloud password so I can back up again?
Right.
But you can't get that prompt because you can't unlock the phone.
So if this guy's phone was backing up every day, no problem. But if it was been a week before, since it last backed up for some reason, then the data is not as fresh. So the FBI already has the data that's on iCloud of whatever the last backup is.
6 weeks prior.
Okay.
And from the FBI's point of view, they know this information exists. They know there's a way to conceivably access it. We've probably all watched CIS. Am I saying
CSI.
That right? CSI. Thank you. I knew that. I got that wrong.
Crime scene investigation.
I guess we don't watch that.
I actually did not watch it either.
I don't either.
there is this huge meme around the culture of how hard police will and FBI will work to get the data.
To do their job? Yeah, you'd think.
They go through incredible lengths to figure out the most minute details that lead to convicting criminals.
And that, of course, is because you don't know what detail is going to be effective.
But imagine,
we're not prosecuting anybody here.
Just imagine knowing that data exists and there is a conceivable way to get it. They want that power.
If I was doing that job, I'd want that too.
But if they got that power, that opens the precedent that would allow them to ask for that in the future, to compel a company to write something which the people who write that software spend an entire career, years and years, studying exploits and figuring out the right way to keep things secure and building on that over and over again. And you're going to turn around and you're going to ask them to do something which has been legally said to be free speech. To write software is legally protected as free speech, and make them write something that they don't want to write.
Okay. Getting access to services and software and stuff has been that's happened for a long time. Skype famously has a backdoor that was added after Microsoft got access to Skype, because most likely the government said, hey, we want to be able to tap Skype calls. They're really important. And so a backdoor was basically added in our system of place that to be able to tap Skype, if you will.
To be equivalent of our normal telephone system.
Right, which kind of makes sense because it is similar to a phone system, and therefore it makes sense those laws are kind of applicable. But in any case, I agree that making the company do something like this is a little weird because they're acting with law enforcement. I kind of agree with the Ted Lieu, the congressman, and other people that are saying the similar thing. But at the same time, it seems to me, because Apple can do this, that's a security flaw, right? We have to trust Apple won't do this anytime they want. And that, of course, it's a trust. And it would be better if the system was put in place such that they couldn't do it. And that brings in the secure enclave, right? The new phones that have the fingerprint identification, the actual encrypted thing is inside of a piece of hardware that can't be tampered with the outside. That you can only guess this many times is true to the hardware, and there's no way to patch it for the software. Yeah?
Well, not entirely true. Oh, Apple has stated throughout this process that if it's not important that it was the 5C, there is ways to update the secure enclave itself. Now, the question is,
and that's
whether,
why it's also forwardly a problem.
Yes, it would be harder.
Right.
It would definitely be a harder problem. The question is whether Apple will attempt in the future to build silicon, to build a chip that doesn't have that ability and has everything it needs programmed on it for the lifetime of the phone.
I am sure those conversations are already happening.
Now, let's also be clear that this ruling is not just about Apple. I mean, or this back and forth, legal back and forth. It would also affect Google with regard to Android operating system.
Sure.
It would affect Samsung with their branch of the Android operating system.
And Microsoft phones and BlackBerry too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the three people that have a Microsoft phone, yes. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
And think about it in the future when our refrigerators and our light bulbs and everything else in our house also has a chip in it. So this is more than about Apple. This is about a precedent that's going to establish that whatever security is put into a device, the FBI or any law,
any court order,
but any government around the world can have a reason to request that the company break the security that they built into that device.
Mm-hmm.
Which then goes into whole market forces. If someone does this for Apple or Google, someone's going to come up, that may be a smaller party or whatever, it's going to come up with something that the browser for the mobile phone is a custom OS that only uses Tor for browsing.
Right.
That only, that only handles PGP encryption for email back and forth.
What you're saying is that the ability to encrypt and do things of that nature is not owned by Apple. Anybody can do this. So you theoretically just have another company produce a piece of software that allows encrypting on top of the phone, and then Apple couldn't break it anyway. I mean, this is not something that can just be magically solved. It's not
right. To me, it's similar to the whole issue with gun control and the fact that there are 3D printers that can print guns now.
The 3D printers that can print guns, yes.
Yes. The horse is out of the barn. Like, you can't get him back in again.
Right.
Like, you need to figure out what you're going to do with the new lay of the land because it's now different.
So let's imagine if they could do this. If they could unlock the phone and access anything that's on there. They can't necessarily access anything on there because if somebody was using another app that encrypts its data itself, then they're still locked out of that. And that encryption is still likely unbreakable provided the password was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So what your point is...
At the same time, though, you could have an order of, you know, we want to follow this person, update their operating system so that there's also a keylogger in it and all the keylogger goes back to us. And then we'll take the phone back and unencrypt the phone. Like if you have this precedence where you say, hey, company, put this stuff in here for us, a lot of stuff could be put in that would make the phone untrustworthy.
Well, that gets back to politics. And imagine this. Imagine the FBI has nothing to lose here. Imagine this case goes all the way to the Supreme Court and they lose the case and Apple maintains the right to not break their own security for them.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then? They can easily go to Congress. And they have a fantastic reason to say, Congress, you must by law mandate that any commercial entity in the United States put in some way for us to break the encryption in the future.
And that's the potential argument. I mean, it's definitely an argument that law enforcement would want at some level. And I take it that both of you are against that methodology?
The more, as time goes on, operating systems on mobile devices or on devices in general have become more and more secure, Internet of Things notwithstanding. and more they're set up in such a way that you're trying to think of all the different ways that you can break into a device. Let's take those away. Compared to when the iPhone was first released, the operating system is light years ahead in terms of security.
And your point?
So if you get to that point where you say you must provide a way for us to get into the device, you are retarding that process. You are saying we are always going to leave this door open, even though there may be an attack vector for it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's remember what our phones hold. Our phones hold our financial information. They can hold our health information. They can hold our private photographs. They can hold all the things we don't want our neighbors to know about us. They can hold anything that would be incriminating about us that is not a legal problem. It's about holding that stuff secure. And if our laws mandate that our companies not keep that as secure as possible, then other companies around the world that are not based in the U.S., not selling things in the U.S., are not going to be limited by that. And we put ourselves at a disadvantage as a country, and we're already the country that is absolutely the best at breaking these kind of things. And why would we put ourselves at the same level as other countries as far as the defensive measures when our offense is so good and we can already get the information that nobody else can?
As a side note, I'm actually curious as to what data they think they're going to get. If it's phone calls, you can go to the carrier, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, whatever, to find out what calls were being made.
Same with location data.
Like, what's their goal? It's not prosecution, right? They want to figure out the crime, maybe want to see if there's other suspects. So you said earlier that that's unlikely.
I'm actually curious as to what data would be on there. Photographs?
Photographs, yeah. GPS information?
No, because
more direct, more specific.
The cell phone information, the cell phone towers give them that. Maybe communications through iMessage or some other chat. But there's not any indication that I know of about other accomplices.
And Apple's going to know all the iMessage kind of communication they potentially could have done because they had to keep track of the handshaking initially.
Now,
they built on the metadata who they talked to. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty light amount of information that you're going to actually glean at that point.
Right. Yeah. And they had the accomplices, the criminals had two other cell phones they destroyed, which obviously were important to them.
Okay. So I don't want to go too long on this, but Tim Cook writes this open letter. The FBI responds. What's the FBI's response?
The FBI's response is everybody needs to calm down. Basically, this is about one case. This is about one phone. And this is not a slippery slope into any sort of future problem.
Okay. Yeah, but that's, of course, the argument they'd have. Is there any other tech companies or other people in the tech space or security people talking about this and have opinions? Well, Miles, you mentioned...
Quite a few on in security, but yes, the CEO of Google...
Your formal boss.
I guess he was my boss for a short period of time. Yeah, he's come out saying, yeah, we're on the side of Apple. Apple's right. This is going to set a dangerous precedent.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Facebook, what's his name?
Zucker something or
Zucker
other.
Something or other. And many other people have come out. It's funny. Did you read Sundar Pichai's, Google's response?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that seem kind of weak
they were,
to you?
There were a series of five tweets, if memory serves.
Yes.
So they were relatively short and terse. And I don't blame him for doing that, to say, like, this is the side we're on. This is what I think we're in support, but not really.
Right. They don't really want to be the focus point of the conversation. I don't have a long post. Well, I think it's fascinating. No matter where you head on this case or think about this politically, the geeks here, we all feel pretty strongly that when you weaken security like this, you really do a disservice to privacy in general, and the privacy is really quite important. And if you think of, like, right now, we go, I can do without my phone. Yeah, it's true. Right now, you can deal without your phone. You do not need a smartphone. But our society is clearly moving more and more where that's more and more important and required at some level. At some point, it'll be very hard to log into bank information again without having your phone authenticated. This stuff is going to be more and more influential in how you run your life. From my perspective, at some point, I'd love for a more communicative democratic society, and I see that a technology could afford that. We could have more rapid response and organization of our democracy with better means of collecting information, like personalized votes and things of that nature. And the smartphone kind of becomes the place that would probably emerge.
Well, let's be clear. If they could break the encryption, if they could do this type of thing, we likely would be safer. Safer in terms of, yeah, if there were a crime going on, you knew, okay, we're going to get this phone, we're going to crack it, and we're going to, you know, get the data out of it. But that is not the only question to ask. Mm-hmm. For example, it was very hard to hide information in East Germany in the 60s. Like that's not the argument. The argument is saying, when you have a certain set of liberties, what is the line that you cannot cross, even though it would be expedient in the moment for law enforcement or politics or whatever?
Awesome. Well, you guys, thank you so much for chatting with us about that. That was great. Any wrap up?
Yeah, there's one other point that I just want to make, because there's a lot of people that have talked about how Apple has done this before. And I just want to be really clear. There is 70-some cases where Apple has helped law enforcement to get into a phone and get data off of it. What's different about this case is this is using iOS 9, where everything on that is encrypted by the passcode you put in. In previous attempts, times they've assisted, there were areas of the operating system, areas of the storage, which were not fully encrypted, and they were able to not break the encryption, but rather access that data and give it to law enforcement.
Right. Interesting. Cool. This is GeekSpeak on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm talking with Brian Young and Miles Elam. We'll be right back. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Hey, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak is available for your later perusal. We put up stories and pictures, and of course, all the audio is available in the podcast. Just go to geekspeak.org, learn all about it. All right. Brian and Miles and I, we're chatting all about security and privacy and all that. We're now going to move on to kind of interesting story about GitHub now and such. The current open source development environment right now is kind of centered around this one company in Silicon Valley called GitHub. And I think last week we talked a bit about what Git is, but basically it's source control. It's the ability for people to collaboratively write code. And one of the ways you collaboratively write code is that if I'm writing some code and Miles sees something and it's open, right? And he sees, oh, there could be a fix that if you improve it. He makes a change to my source code, and then he submits what's called a pull request. That pull request is something that I can control and decide whether I want to merge it in. Meaning, he says, here's a change. I think it's important. This is why. I review it. We can talk about it, chat about it. Maybe I suggest a change. And then at the end of it, I might approve that pull request. That whole process is how open source software works.
So this is not a great analogy, but I think it might illustrate it. Anybody who's used Word with the tracking changes feature on, and you can see in the margin the changes that were made previously, this is that on steroids.
That's exactly the point I made last week on the Geekspeak. That's awesome. I love that you and I think so closely together. Exactly. And the other thing about it is that instead of it just being it's kind of like a pending change until the owner of the document says yes. Right? Okay. So that's a pull request. All right. Tell us what's going on in this new study on GitHub.
So if there was this large repository of data sitting out there that open to the public, if you're a researcher, wouldn't you want to look at it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So some researchers have, and they were looking at it for the question of gender bias. They were trying to see if there was any gender bias in who accepts, when somebody submits a pull request, whether that change is accepted into the project. And
because sometimes the changes are not accepted, sometimes they are accepted, right?
Yeah, yeah. If the author, or I'm sorry, the what do you call it? The person?
The owner, maintainer. The maintainer of the code, yeah.
The maintainer of the project gets to choose whether they want to accept those changes, because there's differences in agreements on all sorts of things. Well, if they take a look at the change and they can determine a gender to the person, just determining the gender alone will reduce the possibility that they're going to accept that pull request.
So the things they know from right off the bat from the pull request is a username on GitHub. And that username can be quite obscure or it can be really clear. What's your username on GitHub, Miles?
TTFKM.
So that, I don't know, is that gender? I don't know if that's even human. TTFM is, of course, the tech formerly known as Miles. Yes?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I know his handle. Nice. Awesome. What's yours, Brian?
You know, from my early days, I always use my name.
Yeah, I do too.
I'm really boring.
So you're Brian on GitHub?
I'm Brian Cordan Young.
Oh, I see your full name. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But it's pretty clear that's probably a guy's name.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mine's Lyle. Probably also a guy's name.
Wait, you got Lyle?
I have Lyle. Yeah. Lyle on the internet. So when we do a pull request, Brian, the person that's receiving it, pretty much, if they're English speakers and stuff, knows what gender we are. And so you're saying that it's more likely, given like a giant sample, it's more likely for Miles's code to be accepted than one of ours because gender is known. Is there also a bias between male and female gender knowledge?
Well, you knew it was going there. So,
I did.
So, yes. So before we get into the weeds of this, I just want to say this is a preliminary study that has not been peer-reviewed. So this is early stuff. But, yes, they found a stronger bias if it was clear that the pull request was submitted by a woman. So there was a bias, even more of a bias, against females submitting pull requests.
What about when the gender is not known by the pull requestee? Like, if I see something like TTFM, and then I receive it,
It's TTFKAM. Thank you very much.
TTFKAM.
So now people can see all the zero amount of code I've written recently.
Well, like I said, that would be the highest acceptance rate of all.
Okay.
And if it was figured out to be male, it would be a little bit less. And it's dramatically less with women. So let's pull out some numbers.
But the best, most interesting thing, though, happens to do when you then research later of the gender knowledge, who's better at coding? Who's going to, like, if you don't know the acronym, if you don't know what the name is, if you don't know if it's male or female, but then later you look at the pull request of those people, the generic gendered, and then you look, is there a difference between men and women's quality of code or acceptance of code?
Yeah. So this is where I don't know if the study really stacks up. But yeah, I mean that's their hypothesis. That's what they're putting forward, that women produce cleaner, more acceptable code if the gender is not known. It's accepted more readily than if it is known.
So which points pretty clearly to women coding better.
It,
which, of course,
does.
Is the article title.
That's the article title. But this is where studies, especially, I mean, first of all, the amount of people in the study is huge. We're talking about public repositories of large amounts of projects, 1.4 million users. So that's excellent
good statistics.
Data.
So
even a small percentage point difference is significant.
But now, and I've got to say that this pull request is not about the quality of code. It's about the idea that my suggestion of what you're doing could be changed, and the communication of that change and the implementation of that change. Yes, there's skill involved in programming, but a lot of it also is about the communication of it. There's a whole process in place, and also the when to decide to make a pull request versus not. Right? There's definitely a lot less women coding on GitHub, and because of in the tech industry, it's like 80-20. It's like a horrible gender discrepancy into the male's favor. So I could definitely see there's side effects, not about individual people being better programmers, but the process in which they decide to make a pull request. Women seem to be doing better jobs of that.
And I love the idea that women potentially are better, more organized thinkers about submitting this stuff. I can totally believe it. I totally support it.
Bad pull request. Last pull request I got from Miles was confusing as hell.
But what I wonder... What I wonder is, I mean, unfortunately, the percentage of women in the community is so small. Is there some self-selecting bias that the ones that actually survive in the community are already gone through the
hardened,
fire?
If you will.
Hardened,
yeah.
If you will.
Maybe.
So,
I was thinking a lot of pull requests, the pull requests that I have submitted on GitHub, Lyle's repository notwithstanding.
No. You're awesome, dude.
A lot of them have to do with whether you're following the same code style as someone else. If you have a particularly strange bit of code, then you're going to be putting comments on there, describing it. So yeah.
Yeah, so
there's more to it than just the algorithm.
Right, it's the communication style. And in fact, I think that's really quite important. Also, the idea of understanding what the receiver would want to hear. Like, all those attributes are much more complicated than simply programming. In fact, probably more important is the way you communicate that. Hey, and speaking about communication, if you'd like to communicate with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at geekspeak.org. You can reach us via Twitter and Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks, all one word. If you have questions or comments or corrections, please feel free to let us know. We'd love to hear about them. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online, or sorry, with David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark with David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geek said hello. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, we've got the whole archive up at GeekSpeak.org. I want to thank our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, and our Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 8 of our 16th season. Miles Elam, Brian Young, thank you so much for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, this is great.
Miles, do you want to cover the other story about women not being treated fairly online? Wait. Let me be more clear because that's too ambiguous. The eBay story.
Okay. So this one has to do with people selling on eBay. And there are two categories of things that you sell on eBay. Used stuff and the new stuff. The cast-offs versus the, fresh off the plane. What they found was that with regard to used items, there was a gender gap still, but it was very small. It was that,
you mean when the seller is a female versus a male, there's a different price point. And of course, with a lot of data, all this data is public, you can see that there's actually...
Or rather the auction, where the auction goes up. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So like I could sell some used toothpicks, and a woman could sell some used toothpicks, and I would get more money for the used toothpicks.
Yeah, you get 3 cents more for the dollar, or somewhere thereabouts.
3% more, all right, for used stuff.
However, if you're selling a new item, women received only 80 cents for every dollar for the exact same or similar products on eBay.
Oh, that sounds like it tracks with the workforce.
This was reported today in Science. Yeah.
Ugh. So if you're selling on eBay, make sure you're... Wait, what about gender neutrality? What if you don't know the gender?
I don't know that one.
Ah, interesting. But if you're selling on eBay, have a male name. That's depressing as hell.
Yeah, and it may not be it's a woman, I'm going to give her less money. That's not how sexism, or racism for that matter, works. It's
It's more many horrible
times,
than that.
Yeah, it many times stems from an unconscious gender bias. Yeah. Like, it's you don't even think about it. And for an individual person, you may not even be able to track it easily, but you track it over populations. And when you if you look at that raw data, the trends become obviously uncomfortably clear.
Yeah.
Gender gap of 3% for used products, 19% for new products.
Is there studies about what wording is and photo quality and things of that nature too? Or I guess if you just do it in mass, then you'll have gender as it. I mean, if you have enough sample size, you would balance for that. Meaning that I know there's a lot of, like, you can actually sell. I was actually reading this great article about this woman that has made, like, years of money. She's been selling stuff on eBay for the last 3 or 4 years, and that's been her primary income. Even though she's also a developer and does a lot of open source work. That's why I was following her blog. And she wrote this whole article about selling stuff and how she buys stuff and then resells it. And all you have to do is, like, have more pictures, have better descriptions, say it's awesome, have more pictures. Like, pictures are really important, I guess. So it's interesting that I'm just curious if there's other side effects, like other reasons rather than just knowledge of gender and whether they balanced for that.
Yeah, that's interesting because I followed my wife through her career and we talked about gender issues a lot. And one of the things that we've heard identified and we've seen ourselves is just a significant lack of confident words, a significant lack of really selling yourself. So in the actual act of selling an object, are there descriptions, are there their attempt to sell it not communicating the same thing as the other male sellers?
The hair on the back of my neck is just raised because it's three guys talking in a room about sexism. And as much as we are all feminists, we don't understand the perspective well enough to really be experts at it.
Or we don't know it intimately. We know about it because women told us and we chose to believe that. No, really, it's happening. Oh, you mean like this? Yes!
Yes, this happens all the time. So I tend to believe that it's not about the quality of, that's a personal decision.
No, you just said quality. I'm not assigning that to it. I'm talking about a culture that we've built up, a culture that we've taught our daughters for generations that we've been trying to break, but is so ingrained in us that even those of us who admit that we are sexist because we know that we must have that bias because we're a product of that culture, even us are not able to fully break it.
Yeah. So if you're selling on eBay, use a male name. God, it's horrible. Hey, thanks, guys. Unless there's any of the stories you want to cover on the post show, we're good? Miles, Brian, thanks. See you next week.
All right.